Atlanta Life Radio Station, WALR, bringing you the best in talk radio.
Hello, and how's everybody doing here on a Wednesday evening on AtlantaLifeRadio.com? This is another episode of Let's Talk Going Gym Free. I'm Mark in California, Beth in Texas. Beth, good evening to you. How are you?
Doing good. I am so glad fall is here. It's getting cooler. It's not like you're sweltering when you walk outside, which is really nice for Texas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, and it's hard to believe that September is almost over, and we are going to have a very interesting interview coming up in the second half hour. I got a couple things off the top that I wanted to talk to you about. First of all, I've got a little bone to pick with you, Beth, and the first bone is that your Indianapolis Colts beat my San Diego Chargers on Sunday.
I was
not real happy about that, but in typical San Diego fashion, they choked it away in the fourth quarter, and perhaps they need some mental wellness to get them going for this week. But congrats to you. I know you're a Colts fan. And because you are a Colts fan, they're kind of my second favorite. I kind of root for them because of you. And so I don't really mind losing to them as much as to other teams. So.
Well, that was the nicest thing you've ever said to me.
Really?
No, but that was nice because I actually thought of you. I was like, oh, Mark, I'm sorry, but yay, Colts, go Colts.
Yeah, no, and I'm sure Indianapolis fans are thankful this week that we gave you guys one. So that helps them feel better as they slide into fall. Okay, so football out of the way. Prostate second half hour. We're really running the gamut now. We're going to go prostate, football, whatever you want to talk about. I want to tell people that last night I was in Vegas, and I was honored. Your boy, Beth, I was honored to be called to host this event for IA Healthcare. They're a travel nursing company, and they did it in Vegas, and sometimes I'll do different events for them because they like my background, my old media background, so they like me to interview people and put stuff together for them. So it was a great event. It was Vegas. It was right across the street from Planet Hollywood. In and out of there quickly, one night. That's perfect for me for Vegas, but I wanted to give a big thank you to them for letting me do that. So anytime someone has me do an event like that, I'm always honored and I'm humbled. And I'm going to put out the picture that I took because I took this picture and I thought of you when I took it. I said, Beth is going to get such a good laugh because this might be the only time I'm ever seen on a red carpet. So there you go.
You're so funny.
I was on the red carpet.
I know. And I saw the picture. You looked really sharp. It was great.
Yes. I kind of look like one of those actors that you're not quite sure who it is. But you're like, have I seen him in something? definitely not an A-lister. Definitely not an A-list actor. So,
vacay in Vegas. That was nice. A little vacation.
A little vacation. Very, very, very quick. You know, I used to like Vegas a lot. I really did. And then over the span of a couple of years back in the day, I probably went, I don't know, 8, 10, 11 times. And every time it got shorter. It got shorter because it was, how much can you walk that strip and see the people and the coins in the casino, the ding, 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 ding.
Yeah.
You can't. So, but it was great. And I did have a chance to talk to some people there about what we're doing with the show. And I was always a fan of when I first got brought in to do work with them. Always a fan of the nursing profession. We don't talk about that much on this show, but nurses do, as you know, incredible work. So I got to see it firsthand when I traveled with some of them for about a year when we were doing Nurse TV, and they do great work. And they need some wellness too, because they are stressed out in 12-hour shifts and on their feet all day. So I hope a lot of them listen, and I hope we can give them some advice, because they need wellness advice too, because they are stressed, and that is hard, hard work.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. My mom was a nurse. She was a nurse in the emergency room. Mm-hmm. She loved it though. She loved the hustle and bustle and working in ER, and she thrived on that.
Yeah. And those hats off to your mom for doing that, because that's really hard work. But your mom probably, yeah, like a lot of them call themselves adrenaline junkies. They love that mm-hmm. kind of fast paced, ER setting. So yeah, it was fun. So it was fun. It was a little mini vacation. And you like to vacation. I know that. Do you have any good, have you been anywhere lately? Any good vacation stories, any good ones, bad ones? Anything you want to get off your chest where you're like, God, that was miserable?
Well, my best vacation ever was in Blue Ridge Mountains. Just, I love the mountains. I love to hike. I love the mountain bike ride. I just love the woodsy. But worst vacay I ever had was my 30th birthday. I actually took, sadly enough, about 16 high school girls. I was a dance coach. And we made it to Nationals in Florida, and it just so happened to be over my 30th birthday. So I made plans to kind of piggyback a couple days extra. I had a cousin that lived down there. I had a friend that lived, you know, pretty close by. So I took 16 high school girls to the Nationals in Orlando, Florida, and we ended up going to Epcot. We went to Disney World, and, I mean, as an adult, if you've ever been to Disney World, just kind of imagine standing in line at the DMV. I mean, it was just horrible.
God love you for tolerating that. Oh, my goodness. That does not sound – you hit it right on the head, too. For an adult, Orlando, and no offense to anybody in Orlando because the city's fine, but the whole Epcot thing, wow, to take 16 people –
Mm-hmm.
You are a good person, my friend.
Yeah, that was probably the worst vacation, although I did enjoy the air-conditioned ride back to the hotel. I think that was my favorite ride of the day. Seriously, that was a really bad vacation. It was just stressful. I didn't realize having these hormonal teen girls with me and being in charge with two extra moms. And anyway, so, yeah.
You know, I had a... It's funny that you brought up that vacation. I had a friend of mine that got married, and their honeymoon was, get this, 2 weeks in Orlando going to Epcot and all of those things. And I said, holy cow, 2 weeks doing that? You guys, and I said, you're adults, and that seems like a very, very long time to be doing those kinds of things. I figured that would be a weekend thing, right? 2 weeks in Orlando to do all of those parts.
Lord.
Wow. So, yeah, I don't know about that as a honeymoon, as a vacation. But good for you. That's. Did you have a good vacation story, or do you have anything that?
Good vacation. I just remember my girlfriends and I from college. Every year we would meet up at a different place every summer, and we did that until careers and families started coming, but we did that for years. We went to, Colorado. That was a lot of fun. The vacations where I get to be outdoors and hike is a good vacation. So mm-hmm. Colorado Springs, Denver, Blue Ridge Mountains, Tennessee, those have been the best for me. So what about you? What's your best vacation?
I haven't been back to Europe since I was in at the end of high school. So that's a long, long time ago. But I'm going to answer that kind of in a combined thing. So a couple years ago, every year I would take with a buddy of mine, we would do a baseball vacation. And we would just go for a weekend, and we would just pick a city, and we'd meet in the city on a Friday night. I'd fly in, he'd fly in, and then we would go to, because we were both from San Diego, so we were Padre fans, but not like face painting, jersey wearing fans. we didn't go down that road. Mm-hmm. So Prescott doesn't really do face painting or jerseys. That's another story entirely. But we would go, and so we did a bunch of different ones. We would pick random ones. So we did, you know, Cincinnati, Milwaukee, Denver, all over. And I had done some of my own too, like St. Louis. They were like these little mini vacations, because by the time you got in, Friday night had dinner, and then Saturday you'd go do the game and hang out, and it was just a couple of guys just having fun, talking baseball life, and then Sunday we would just get on our separate planes, and he now lives in Boston, but he lived in L.A. at the time, so he would go back to L.A., I'd go back to San Diego, and it was these little, they were like these little mini getaways. So,
oh, that's good. Get to the soul.
We're going to do that. I want to do that with you, but I think you're more of a jersey wearing face painting. Are you face painter? You're not. Okay, good. All right, good.
Jersey, but no face paint. How's that?
Okay. No, jersey's fine. The jersey's fine. So if people are just joining us on the show, they can follow us on Twitter at ALR Radio and at Going Gym Free. Also like us on Facebook. And you can send us emails at goinggymfree@gmail.com. You can check out our YouTube channel, too. Just go on to YouTube and type in Going Gym Free. You can also download our shows on iTunes and Stitcher. Before we get to the Ask Beth segment, which is one of my favorite segments, let's talk. So next segment, Curtis Pettaway from MD Anderson, Professor of Urology. He's going to talk about Prostate Cancer Awareness Month. We can't get the word out about this enough, right, Beth? I mean, this affects so many men, so many families, so many people have questions about this. It seems like you're reading a different study about this all the time. So I think we're picking a good time to shed some light on this topic, don't you think? We recorded the interview, and I thought he was fantastic, don't you think?
No, yes, he was very informative I really enjoyed the interview, and I can't wait to hear it back, played back.
Yeah, no, he was great, and so we have that coming up in the second half hour. So, Beth, put on your wellness cap now, and you know how I lean on you for this information. So, are you ready for the first question? Should we just throw it out there for you?
Throw it out.
Okay, hold on one second. Let me find it here. I think it's about protein. Okay, here we go. How much protein do I need a day, and is it important to eat right after a workout?
You know, Mark, I get this question a lot. I can say this is probably one of the top five questions that I've asked, and that really depends on if you want to lose weight, gain muscle, slim down, if you're really active, if you're moderately active or not active at all. But a general rule is if you work out and you want to gain muscle and slim down, you should eat about half your body weight in ounces a day of quality protein. And what I mean by quality protein is whey protein, grass-fed beef, chicken, the lean proteins. And on the days that you don't work out, you still need protein, but a little bit less. I'm going to say maybe 3/4 of what you would eat on a workout day. And I encourage people to eat about 20 to 25 grams per setting, not the mass amounts like the 40 to 60 grams of protein or more, because your body's just going to process it better if you eat a little bit kind of throughout the day. And in terms of timing and when you work out, I know you've heard this, Mark, but you're going to hear people talk about the golden hour or the anabolic window, which is a period of time after you work out that leads to the best recovery. And usually this time frame is between 45 minutes to an hour after your workout. And what you eat post-workout is important, but I'm going to say not for the reasons that most people think. The primary reason post-workout food is so important, again, the quality protein, is to provide your body with immediate fuel source to prevent it from breaking down muscle tissue for energy. So I advise people to include some fast-digesting carbs, some healthy carbs, along with protein after you finish your workout. And that's because the carbs are going to help spare your body's own energy source, and the protein will help repair and encourage muscle growth and strength. So I also tell people, don't be worried if you can't eat immediately after you finish your exercise. Although that anabolic window is important, building muscle is not just what you do immediately afterward or your post-workout. It's kind of what you do with your overall diet, having the balance of the fats, the carbs, and the protein.
So let me throw you, before we get to the other question, I'm going to kind of throw one on you here, kind of spur of the moment. So how about telling people, so that's awesome advice, and you're spot on with that. So what about people, Beth, about when they say before they're going to go work out, they're going to take a bike ride, they're going to take a long walk? I mean, maybe they're mixed up about should they eat some carbs or should they have a banana? Maybe give a simple tip about that before a workout. I know this wasn't part of one of our questions, but I'm piggybacking on what you said because I think it's perfect. It goes right with this.
No, I think that's a great question. And honestly, I don't encourage people to eat unless you're going to do like a soccer game or a football game or something that's going to or a marathon, let's say. I really don't encourage people to eat too much before a traditional workout. You can have maybe an apple or a banana, but eating before your workout, I think it's kind of, unless you're hungry. If you're hungry, have something that's not going to jar when you're running or when you're working out, like maybe whole wheat bread and fava butter or something like that. But really the main focus is after the workout.
Yeah, no, I think that's great. That's perfect. How about this one? Because we did talk about this a couple of weeks ago, and this is a question that I get asked quite a bit. A couple of weeks ago, we were talking about probiotics, encouraging people to take a probiotic maybe before a multivitamin. So I guess that kind of leads into, does that mean that a multivitamin isn't an important thing for the everyday routine? So what say you about that, Beth?
I don't remember saying taking it before a multivitamin, but to kind of clarify everything, yes, I did say, and I do feel that probiotics are really important. And if someone had to choose between a multivitamin and a probiotic, I would encourage the probiotic. But that doesn't mean I don't think a multivitamin is important. I mean, you know this, I know this, and most people know that a healthy, well-rounded diet is key to getting the best vitamins and minerals, but the average person isn't getting that. So supplements can help fill in those nutritional gaps if you can't eat all the essential vitamins from your food. So, for instance, if you're doing your best to eat healthy foods, but you're still deficient in vitamin D, which most of us are, or if vitamin C type foods give you acid reflux, like the, grapefruit and oranges and things like that, supplements really can help. But again, the key is to ensure they're taken in addition to a healthy diet and eating those healthy foods and nutritional dense foods. And I always tell people, remember, they're supplements, not replacements. So if you need, that supplement to help supplement your daily food intake, by all means, and I take one. Mm-hmm. I had just said that I thought a probiotic was maybe a little bit more important than the multivitamin.
Yeah, and you, I don't know if you read as much about, I'm sure you do, but it's weird because especially in the last, it seems like in the last year or so, and maybe you can weigh in on this, Beth, it seems like in the last year or so you read more about multivitamins. It's kind of like either people are for them or some say they swear by them. Other people say they don't do anything at all. Is it more of a placebo effect? Did people just feel like they feel better because they are taking multivitamin? Is it really doing anything? So it's really interesting. And again, I'm not a doctor. I'm not a nurse. Neither are you. But do you find that kind of is an interesting – and I mean, it seems to me what I read that more people that are taking the probiotics, they feel better or whatnot. But do you read about a lot of that too with the multivitamins, and where do you kind of stand on that? Or am I just reading whatever on the internet?
Well, I think if you're reading from, a reputable source and by all means take that advice and take your doctor's advice. But again, I think with folks not eating, I mean, if you're eating clean and you're eating healthy and you're having your 5 to 9 veggies and fruits a day and getting your fats, your healthy fats, and you're just eating healthy, I mean, obviously you're not going to need a multivitamin, but I'm going to say 90% of the population don't get the vitamins and the minerals that they need. Now, I'm not going to get my multivitamin off a grocery store shelf. I'm going to order them from a good quality. So, and I don't know about you, there are days where I just really can't. I'm just so busy, and I'm from meeting to meeting to meeting, I just don't have time to eat healthy, or I'm eating on the road. So I take a multivitamin, and I'm not anti-multivitamins at all. So I do think they can benefit people, but I also think if you're eating healthy and you're getting the vitamins, you don't need it. So, I mean, that's kind of sitting on the fence a little bit, but I honestly think multivitamins are important if you're not getting the vitamins you need from your food.
Yeah, and you know, I think you brought up a good point before we go to break. We should do a show one time about how to eat healthy and exercise on the road. And I know that there's tons of info out there that experts write about this, but it is so hard to do that. It really is. I mean, even when I was just in Vegas, I mean, you are just surrounded by so much temptation with food that I really feel like, I have to focus even more and say, hey, I'm really going to make sure I walk, get my 10,000 steps. My food might be a little off today. I think just giving people simple tips about that people that travel a lot, because it's easy to fall into that fast food, poor diet, soda, relaxing in a hotel room so you feel like you're going to spoil yourself a little more. It's tough to do that on the road. I really believe that.
It is.
Don't you think? I mean, it's something that you really have to be conscious of when you're out. It's kind of my little rant about that, because I just got back from being on the road. So, I don't know. And maybe I'm the one that can't stay healthy on the road.
Yeah,
I really,
it is difficult.
You know, it's so hard. Oh, my gosh.
It is difficult. Just a little bit of planning. Just a little bit of planning. But I would love to do a show on that. Let's do that in December, because people are going to be taking vacations and visiting family. So we can do that in December.
Oh, good call. Good call. Thanks for picking me up. That's good. That's perfect. Okay. Well, I think we're good. We're kind of running out of time here on the first segment. But coming up after the break, we will have Dr. Curtis Pettaway. And good information, so stay tuned for that, and we will be right back.
Hi, this is Executive Producer Mel D, and we thank you for tuning into today's show. Today's show would not be made possible without the support of our loyal sponsors. If you own a business, offer a service, or are a fan of the show, become a sponsor. Please go to our website at www.AtlantaLifeRadio.com to the Advertise With Us page to view and download our new advertising kit. We offer new and affordable opportunities for you to become a part of our shows. And now we return back to our program.
And we are back on a beautiful Wednesday evening as we enter into the fall here on Atlanta Life Radio. If you're just joining us, you're listening to AtlantaLifeRadio.com. If you want to send us an email, by all means, goinggymfree@gmail.com. Also, like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at ALR Radio. And at Going Gym Free, you can also download our podcast, which is pretty cool, on Stitcher and iTunes. Now, as Beth and I were talking about in the first half hour, this is a Prostate Cancer Awareness Month. So we wanted to bring in an expert. Let's bring in Dr. Curtis Pettaway. He is a professor of urology at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. Dr. Pettaway, thanks so much for taking a few minutes with us. How are you? How's it going?
Doing well. Happy to be here.
Yeah, thanks so much for the time. Dr. Pettaway, why don't you just give us a little, before we get into what this month means and all of those things and the awareness, just tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, what you're doing these days.
Okay. My area of interest is urology, and specifically, since I work at MD Anderson, it's urologic cancer, and the areas that I'm involved in are prostate cancer, penile cancer, and some of the rarer lower genitourinary cancers. And, since this is Prostate Cancer Awareness Month, I'm happy to talk to you a little bit about that.
Dr. Pettaway, in my life, I had an uncle that had prostate cancer as well as a couple of coworkers, but I've heard that prostate cancer is one of the most common cancers. Do we know what causes it or how to prevent prostate cancer?
Well, you're right. Prostate cancer is the most common cancer affecting males over the age of 50 in the United States. And if you look worldwide, it is probably the most common cancer in the developed countries. We don't know what causes prostate cancer, but as you might imagine, one of the major risk factors is having a Y chromosome or being a male. The thing that is certainly clear is that as you get older, the likelihood of having prostate cancer diagnosed increases. And in fact, they've done studies on men who have died of other reasons, and when they've done autopsies on these men, many of these men have prostate cancer. It's usually small and would not have been diagnosed clinically, but as you get older, based on these autopsy studies, there's a higher incidence of prostate cancer just with aging. So that's one of the established risk factors. Another risk factor that's established is a racial and ethnic group. We know that men of African descent have a higher incidence of having prostate cancer. African-American men have about a 60% higher incidence. And unfortunately, the mortality is about twofold higher as well. And, current areas of research, that's certainly one of the hot areas of research these days, trying to determine what may be the reason why African-American men have tended to present with a higher stage of disease, seem to have more aggressive prostate cancer, and have a higher mortality from prostate cancer. Again, that's an area where there's a lot of ongoing research, and there is some data that would suggest that when you look at the molecular profile of prostate cancer among African-American men, it does seem to correlate with a more aggressive profile. Other things also play into the aggressiveness of prostate cancer, as you might imagine, lack of early detection, meaning when you are diagnosed with prostate cancer, instead of being diagnosed at an early stage, perhaps if you didn't have access to health care, you may not have gotten some of the early detection testing that's available, and you come in because of symptoms of prostate cancer. And those men who come in symptomatic from prostate cancer or with symptoms of prostate cancer, they tend to be diagnosed at a later stage. From the standpoint of view of prostate cancer, in terms of established risk factors, those risk factors are older age, African-American race, and there's another risk factor that has to do with the environment. And I'm just going to give it a basket term of environmental exposures. Now, this became known a while back, looking at patterns of migration over time. And let me give you an example. If you look at men in Asia, like Japanese and Chinese men, Filipino populations, the incidence of prostate cancer there is relatively low among men in those populations. But when they come to the United States, over time, their incidence of prostate cancer begins to go up and begins to approach that of males in the United States, like Caucasians in the United States. So that's a scenario where you have men who have the same genetic background, but their environmental exposures become different over time, and they begin to take on the risk of prostate cancer of the same population that they moved to. And of course, one of the big things that one might implicate with respect to exposures would be diet. And so there certainly are some things that we can look at with respect to dietary exposure.
We are talking to Dr. Curtis Pettaway, professor of urology at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. Dr. Pettaway, it is Prostate Cancer Awareness Month. If you have a question, someone could email us in at goingjimfree@gmail.com or on atlantalifradio.com. That kind of leads us into our next question to you, Dr. Pettaway. When we talk about this, this is a show where we talk about general wellness, diet, and exercise. Is there anything we can do as we kind of creep into our 50s to maybe decrease the risk of getting prostate cancer? There's some simple tips you can give us?
Yeah, I think that, you know, with respect to prostate cancer, as we talked about, it's very, very common. And we don't necessarily know what causes it. We certainly know that males are at risk, and all males are at risk. What are some things that have been kind of shown with respect to the literature that might decrease one's incidence of prostate cancer? If we look at dietary manipulation, there have been some components of what we call a heart-healthy diet that have been associated with a lower risk of prostate cancer, like eating fruits and vegetables. And the specific vegetables that have been mentioned are what we call cruciferous vegetables. It's hard for me to pronounce that name. But those are like broccoli, broccoli, cauliflower, red wine has been implicated before in with respect to heart health. And there is a compound called resveratrol in grapes, red grapes, that may be cardioprotective as well. Some other things that have been associated with a decreased prostate cancer incidence or mortality even have been, one, maintaining an ideal body weight, and also exercise. So people that are obese, it is unclear whether they have a higher incidence of prostate cancer or not, but one thing seems to be very consistent in the literature, that obese patients tend to have a higher mortality from prostate cancer. So from the standpoint of view of lifestyle change with respect to maintaining an ideal body weight, having a heart-healthy diet, and getting some exercise, that is a good thing. And I'll tell you what, it seems to be very consistent in most of the cancer literature is that the heart-healthy diet, you know, one could look in the American Heart Association site and look at what they recommend for a heart-healthy diet, and it tends to be prostate-healthy as well. So that's kind of an easy rule of thumb. There are some other things that seem to also provide some evidence for a decreased risk or mortality from prostate cancer. Taking a baby aspirin, there have been some studies that have shown that men who have been on what we call non-steroidal anti-inflammatory agents, and a baby aspirin is a classic one, may have a lower incidence of prostate cancer as well, and that seems to also be cardioprotective as well. The other thing that one can also do is decrease the amount of red meat and or meats cooked at high temperatures in the diet. There are substances called heterocyclic amines that have been associated with a number of cancers, including prostate cancer. In terms of drug therapy, there were two relatively large trials of drugs that are related to the male hormone testosterone, which is testosterone is kind of the hormone that gives men libido. It is also certainly been associated with virilization in men as well. It has some important functions with respect to the heart as well. With respect to prostate cancer, it's kind of controversial if it is related to the development of prostate cancer or not. We know that if boys are castrated before the age of puberty, their prostates basically won't develop. And that's obviously a very severe form of treatment of prevention of prostate cancer. We wouldn't want to do that. But there are drugs that can basically decrease one of the active forms of testosterone called dihydrotestosterone. And they have actually been looked at in the prevention of prostate cancer. And in two different studies, they showed that there was a reduction in low-grade prostate cancers in men who took these drugs that we call 5-alpha reductase inhibitors. One of those drugs, which we call the generic name is called finasteride. The trade name is called Proscar. The other drug is called dutasteride, and its trade name is called Avodart, and it's often, both of these drugs are often used to treat men who have large prostates to shrink the prostate. Well, it turns out in using these drugs, among men who were on the drug versus a sugar pill, there was a lower incidence of some low-grade prostate cancers. And when they looked at all of the evidence, it looked like this was a very consistent result, but unfortunately, a small amount of the men who were on these drugs, very small amount, got high-grade cancers. And it was unclear, you know, whether these drugs were causing high-grade cancers in a small percentage of men. So the Food and Drug Administration really never approved them for the prevention of prostate cancer among a healthy population because they didn't want there to be any possibility that these drugs could cause harm. So in terms of drug therapy, I can't say that we have anything that's approved for use. But in men who have enlarged prostate and urinary symptoms, you know, I will consider using these drugs, and they may get some benefit in terms of prostate cancer prevention.
Wow, this is all such interesting stuff. And eating healthy and exercising, that is what Mark and I preach every week. But I'm sure our audience wants to know, what are the symptoms associated with prostate cancer, and how is it diagnosed?
Okay, well, this is an extremely important question because probably the most common symptom of prostate cancer is no symptom at all. Men can have prostate cancer and have absolutely no symptoms. And that's why early detection with the testing that we have can be an important thing. But just simply, just for the audience's information, I will go through some of the symptoms that one can exhibit. So often men might develop symptoms of what we call lower urinary tract irritation, like frequent urination, or, you know, you get that sensation when you first get the urge to go, you really got to go, or it almost feels like it's going to come out or leak out on you. You can have symptoms of what we call obstruction, meaning that you get the urge to go and you have to stand there about 5 minutes before things start moving. Or it kind of, instead of having a really forceful stream that really jets out, the stream kind of trickles out. And you have to really put a lot of pressure behind it to kind of empty your bladder, or your bladder just doesn't feel like it's emptying at all. Sometimes, because you are not emptying your bladder and the urine is static, you can have symptoms of a urinary tract infection, like frequent urination, burning on urination, fever, things like that. Because the symptoms of prostatic inflammation can be referred to the bone in the front above the penis called the pubic bone, or referred to the back, you can develop back pain or backaches with urinary obstructive symptoms and a kind of a blocked lower urinary tract. These would be certainly advanced symptoms of either a very enlarged prostate or prostate cancer. But the vast majority of men, diagnosed with prostate cancer in this day and age have no symptoms at all. And that's because they're diagnosed at an earlier stage because of the prostate-specific antigen blood test.
I was going to say, Dr. Pettaway, that kind of leads us into the next question. Now, when you're talking about that test, if that test can diagnose prostate cancer, you know, earlier, why did the United States Preventive Services Task Force kind of come out with a statement to not screen for prostate cancer then?
Yeah, so now you're really getting into the hot controversial issue there. you've really stirred the pot on that one. The PSA blood test has been around for a long time, and amongst cancer doctors, it is probably considered to be one of the most important blood tumor markers in all oncology. Because it has really resulted in the earlier diagnosis of cancer. Now, in order for a marker to be an important marker, it not only has to diagnose a cancer earlier, but because you diagnosed it earlier and you treated it earlier, what you should see over time is a decrease in mortality to show the ultimate value of that marker. Are you following me so far?
Yeah, it's just interesting, just listening, yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
So,
mm-hmm.
So what basically has happened is we have found that with PSA, we are clearly diagnosing more cancers than we diagnosed before, and the statistics from the early 90s clearly showed us that. And what we see today is a higher number of cancers diagnosed than what we used to diagnose before the PSA era. Now, the problem is, this gets back to the autopsy studies. Remember when I told you before that men who died of other reasons also had prostate cancer? They didn't die of it. They died with it. So it wasn't really
right.
A problem for them. So mm-hmm. Now what there is a fear of, and what is happening, is the thought is that we are diagnosing more cancers and potentially uncovering more of these occult cancers that would not have produced problems than we would have before without PSA. And so because treatment of prostate cancer can cause side effects like urinary side effects, sexual side effects, we are potentially causing some harm among men who really didn't need the treatment. So that's what the fear of it is. Now, to add fuel to the fire, two large screening studies were done, one in Europe and one in the United States. And the one performed in the United States basically showed that using PSA, although you diagnose more cancers, didn't decrease mortality. So in that study, it showed you didn't decrease mortality, but by treating these earlier cancers, you potentially could cause harm. So then that looks like a negative effect. However, the study in Europe showed that by diagnosing cancers earlier with PSA, you did decrease mortality. and you did decrease the incidence of advanced stage at presentation. So we had two studies that came out at the same time that had the exact opposite result.
That's crazy.
So when the United States Task Preventive Services Task Force looked at all the data, they basically came up with the recommendation that PSA, the magnitude of benefit was unclear, harm could be caused, and that they did not recommend population-based screening as a result of that. Now, there are several practical problems with some of the study designs, and specifically the U.S. study, because theoretically, to do an optimum study, you want to take a population of patients who have not been screened and compare them with a population that has been screened so that you can make some valid conclusions. Well, it turns out in the U.S. study, many of the men, at least 50% of the men in the control arm, had already had PSA testing and were getting tested as the study was ongoing. So that study was really not a study of screening versus no screening. It became a study of some screening versus more screening. So many have basically come to the conclusion that what that study evolved into was not a great screening study, and the conclusions from that study really can't be interpreted in the context of men who were screened versus men who were not screened. And so the European study would appear to be a more valid screening study from that perspective. The other big important thing is that we already know that African-American men have a higher incidence and mortality from prostate cancer, and both of those studies, or neither of those studies, I should say, had significant numbers of African-American men. So while the Preventive Services Task Force came out with that statement for all men, many of us don't believe that the data even apply to African-Americans because they weren't represented in the trial. And so I, for one, believe it is dangerous for African-American men to take that statement as truth and not get screened. What has happened since that time with respect to that recommendation, though, is that many primary care providers are not ordering PSA, and the number of cases of prostate cancer went down dramatically in the year after that recommendation, went down by about 35,000 cases. And so, you know, in the oncologic field, we're kind of holding our breath now because we don't know if we're going to see a return to the more advanced cancers that we used to see before. I think that the bottom line is that we all realize that certainly there must be a way for us to diagnose cancers that are going to cause a problem. And this is going to happen through research and some of the more sophisticated molecular tests today that we can use to separate out the lions or the cancers that are going to cause bad things from the lambs, the ones that would never have caused the problem.
Well, you know, we had a physician on in June for Men's Health, and he actually brought this up. And I remember thinking at the time that was such a bold statement. That was such a but anyway, I'm glad you clarified that for us. And but I want to know, what are some common treatments for prostate cancer for patients out there, or for, you know, men that are thinking about this? And can prostate cancer be cured?
Yeah. That's a very good question. Fortunately, the vast majority of men in the United States where PSA testing is still readily available are being diagnosed with early stage disease. And in that setting, both surgery and radiation are very effective, and the cure rates are very high. And in fact, if you look at five-year survival for localized prostate cancer, it's almost 100% when you look at cancer-specific survival. And importantly, what we've seen in the PSA era is that prostate cancer mortality has been decreasing, and the prior differences in survival between African Americans and Caucasians, those differences are almost being erased nowadays with early detection and prompt treatment. So from that standpoint of view, we do have very effective treatments for localized prostate cancer. And patients that have regional disease, in other words, disease that's spread beyond the prostate, maybe to regional nodes, can still live very long and have their disease controlled sometimes for 10, 15 years even because of a number of treatments that then are able to address cells that are outside the prostate in the blood or the bone. What I mentioned before, drugs that knock out the what we call the androgen signaling access, and that relates to that male hormone testosterone that I was talking about. Being able to knock out testosterone and its downstream signaling is an important target for many of the older drugs and the newer drugs that are available today. For men who have distant metastatic disease, we are seeing some increase in survival among those men with specific types of chemotherapy that are available, and different combinations as well. So even among men who have more advanced disease, we are seeing survivals, you know, from diagnosis of some men with advanced disease of 5 years or so. So, you know, with localized disease, it's curable. With regional disease, it's controllable for longer survival. And men with distant disease, again, it is often the case that those men are living beyond a couple of years, getting survivals in the range of 4 to 5 years. But clearly what we want to do is we want to find optimal treatments for men who have very advanced disease from the outset. That's still our challenge today. With localized disease, we certainly can cure those men. And our challenge in the localized disease setting is to treat the men who really need to be treated, and the men who have these very low-grade localized cancers who were diagnosed with PSA who had no symptoms. One of the growing treatment trends among these men is called active surveillance, and that's really a big paradigm shift, because in our country, what used to happen is if you had a cancer diagnosis, any prostate cancer diagnosis, you immediately got some form of treatment, and that treatment certainly could have caused side effects. But nowadays, given all that we've learned about the biology of prostate cancer and potentially some overdiagnosis with PSA, we're finding that some of these men diagnosed with early cancer, we can just follow them very carefully. You know, checking their PSAs over time, doing additional biopsies over time. And some of these men won't progress in 5 or 10 years just by watching them.
Mm. All right. I got the million-dollar question for you, Dr. Pettaway. This is going to be the last question for you, and you must get this a lot as a doctor. Someone is diagnosed. They're going through treatment. They're kind of in that stage. Maybe the stigma, maybe they come in and they say, all right, Dr. Pettaway, does this mean they might have in their mind, is this the end of having sex now? Am I going to have bathroom issues for the rest of my life? What can I do to make sure that I stay kind of in air quotes normal now when it comes to sexual function and going to the bathroom? Reassure the people out there that life can go on, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. Well, I think that, you know, again, what you want to do with prostate cancer, as with any cancer, I think it's important to be an educated consumer. And that means, you know, reading about the disease and getting a second opinion on any cancer diagnosis or treatment. I can't overstate that. Because, again, when you look at it for the group of men who may have a very low volume prostate cancer that is very low grade, man, it's hard to make that man feel better. And
right.
if he doesn't need treatment that could affect his sexual urinary function, then the best thing for him is to follow him closely and avoid treatment from the outset. So that's where maybe getting a second opinion could be a very important thing. Now, for those men who have what we call clinically significant cancers, cancers of higher volume or higher grade, that could pose a problem to the patient, then the question is, you know, am I going to undergo a surgery-based treatment? Am I going to undergo a radiation-based treatment? Again, getting a second opinion is important because surgery has its own set of side effects and radiation has its own set of side effects. And in some cases, the data for the two of them are very equivalent in terms of the cancer control perspective, and some patients choose surgery and some patients choose radiation. And in that setting, one of the things that you want to do is go to a facility that has a lot of expertise on the treatment of patients with prostate cancer, whether it be surgery or radiation, and really get a good idea on what the expectations are from the surgeon or the radiation oncologist about their experience with sexual and urinary side effects and what can be done to ameliorate or minimize those side effects, or what can be done to rehabilitate the patient after he has treatment. We have a very active sexual function rehabilitation program here at our center for patients who've undergone therapy. We certainly use the orally active medications like sildenafil. We call that Viagra, and the other one, tadalafil, Cialis. There are others as well. We use those very liberally. We use devices that can help a man regain erectile function. Those are called vacuum assist devices. There are medications that we can actually inject or insert into the penis that can assist with allowing a man to have an erection. And even if some of or all of those devices fail, we can actually, in the appropriate setting, use an implant device, which can also help a man have a spontaneous erection without any medication. Those are called penile implant prostheses. And so those are devices that look very natural. When they're surgically implanted, you cannot tell that a device like this is in place, but there's a little pump that is in the scrotum. You can hit the button, and that causes fluid to fill the cylinders that are implanted in the penis, and one has an erection that can last as long as they want. So for an individual who really had no other alternative, he suddenly then is able to regain the ability to have sexual intercourse and vaginal penetration where it wouldn't have been possible previously. So there are a lot of different strategies that we can utilize to affect return of sexual function. With respect to urinary function, what I would say is that early on after surgery, urinary function does tend to suffer with respect to urinary incontinence. And with radiation, there is less of an effect on urinary function. But one of the things is that the body is very resilient. And there are muscles that surround the urethra tube that you urinate through that can help you with exercise regain urinary tract function. The muscle that we're thinking about is called the periurethral striated sphincter, and the muscle I'm sorry, the exercise that we have patients do is called a Kegel exercise. It's like we have them tighten the rectum for about 5 or 6 seconds. That's under their voluntary control. Then have them relax. But we have them do this exercise maybe 60 to 100 times a day. And over time, this muscle gets stronger, and their urinary function resumes to virtually almost normal function. So we expect today that with a properly performed operation that a very, very high percentage of men are going to have resumption of their urinary tract function, you know, over a 3 to 6 month period. And it continues to improve even over a year.
Well, Dr. Pettaway, I wish we had more time. I felt like I was in the classroom there with you, or I was one of your patients. That was absolutely outstanding. Thanks for taking some time for Prostate Cancer Awareness Month. Thanks again so much. Beth, I thought it was great. Great job, Dr. Pettaway, and good information. So thanks so much for coming on. I hope that was painless for you.
Oh, no, I certainly appreciate the opportunity and hope that, you know, I've helped your listeners in some way.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the time.
Yeah, thanks so much. And everybody, thanks for listening. And we'll see everybody back here next week. Have a great week, everybody.